This show furnished by Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervey's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervey. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kaysen. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervey and Kerry Kaysen.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervey, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn. And today, as usual, on this fine Sunday afternoon, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And usually, of course, as everyone knows, I'm here with Kerry Kaysen, who loves to manage people's lives, including my own. But she's not here today. We don't know where she is. She's missing in action. Actually, I think she's on assignment. She does so many shows that I can't keep it straight where she is. I think she's in Vegas, but she's going to miss a good show. And we aim to please our guests. So today, in Kerry's place, we wanted to make sure that our guest was as comfortable as possible. So what did we do? We found a former employee of our guest, a woman who needs no introduction in her own right, former host of Reasonable Doubt on Investigation Discovery, a commentator on CNN and other media outlets like Law and Crime, and the managing partner of Chester and Lefkowitz, criminal defense attorneys, right up our guest. And I keep teasing about our guest because I don't want to disclose it yet. He's done a lot of acting before judges and in courtroom, which has swayed juries. So I'm doing the same for you as a listener. Melissa Lefkowitz, welcome back to Gervey's Law. I'm glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. This is always my favorite place to be in LA.
And I think you want to make sure that Kerry Kaysen stays out of town as much as possible so you can sit in that seat.
I love seeing Kerry. She's so beautiful and brilliant, but I love this chair.
I will tell her that in case she isn't listening. And I know the show today is very special for you, and it isn't a coincidence that we have you here. We interview so many well-known and established as one of the greatest attorneys in the country. We do it all the time. And we haven't had Benjamin Braffman on the show yet. And today we do, and let's talk a little bit about Ben before we get him speaking, because we want to hear what he has to say. He's the founding partner of Braffman and Associates. It depends on where you're from. I'm from Canada, so I say Braffman. You're from the United States, say Braffman. It's a kind of thing. It's drama, drama. I say drama, they say drama. Former district attorney in the Rackets Bureau of the New York County DA's office, been in private practice since 1980. He has had so many notable clients, too many to list, but let's give it a shot for a few of them. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, Plaxico Burress, one of my favorites. Dinesh D'Souza, Michael Jackson for a short time. Martin Shkreli, perhaps the most hated man in the world at that time. Puff Daddy, certainly not one of the most hated men. And by the way, we just had on the show, and you know Ben Mycelis, who's Kenny Mycelis' son. And Puff Daddy actually went to his bar mitzvah. Believe
really?
It or not, I think he performed at his bar mitzvah.
That's wild.
Because Kenny Mycelis actually represented Puff Daddy at the time. So it's kind of like an uncle to him. We want to talk to Ben about that. Also, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Harvey Weinstein and maybe Sammy the Bull Gravano. There's another, you know, the mob boss. A lot of well-known clients. Ben Braffman, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
How was that for an introduction? You probably thought you would never get a chance to take the mic and speak.
No, I've heard most of it before. I just want to make two cautionary comments. One, I only represented Sammy Gravano for a very short time, so he was never really a former client, so I'd just like to straighten that part out. And with respect to Harvey Weinstein, You know, I resigned as his lawyer about 6 months ago, and I've agreed not to discuss his case because I'm no longer authorized to speak on his behalf. Other than that, happy to talk to you about everything and anything. And Melissa, it's good to hear you again.
It's great to have you on. You sound amazing.
Well, I'm trying my best.
You're doing a good job. I got to tell you, a couple of weeks ago, we had Judge Frederick Block on our show, and we spoke to him about his book, about sentencing. And he happened to mention, unprompted, he said the greatest lawyer who ever appeared before him was none other than Benjamin Brofman. And he said that at the same time that Steve Zissou was on the show. And he said, sorry, Steve, you're a distant second.
Well, that's very nice to hear, and I'm flattered. I think Judge Block's first substantial criminal trial when he was appointed to the Eastern District, and it was the Peter Gation case. Peter was the king of nightclub life in New York at the time. It's about 20 years ago.
And also a fellow Canadian, I think.
Right, from Toronto.
That's
and,
right.
Peter, after 8 weeks, was found not guilty of all charges, and it was a great trial for me, and I think it was also a great trial for Judge Block, and he has spoken about that trial often, and I'm constantly pleasantly surprised and flattered by all of the wonderful things he has said to me, and I reviewed his book, and I thought it was terrific, so I like him, too.
It is a terrific book, and I don't know if you want to go out on the limb and say he's the greatest judge that you've ever appeared before, but we're not going to ask you that. You know, with respect to Peter, a lot of people thought he wasn't going to be able to get out of there the way he did, and I think he fled back to Canada, but was that something that was one of these cases where you thought, how am I going to represent him in the best possible way?
Well, Peter was, you know, I think fundamentally innocent of the charges. And I think the government at that time went out of its way to try and fashion a theory of a prosecution that, in my judgment, had, you know, little hope to prevail because you know, Rudy Giuliani, who was the mayor at the time, wanted to put an end to Clubland, and Peter was Clubland. He owned and operated the Limelight, Club USA, the Tunnel, the Palladium. There were no other nightclubs in New York at the time of any note, and Peter was on the front, on the cover of New York Magazine, and sometimes, you know, fame is good, and sometimes it's not. And when they started to try and close down Clubland, they targeted Peter, and they, you know, charged him with running a racketeering enterprise and completely ignored the fact that he had a legitimate club operation. And, you know, we had a very hard-fought, knockdown, drag-out slugfest. And after an eight-week trial, I think Peter was acquitted of all charges in less than 3 hours of deliberation. So for me, at that time, it was a stunning victory. I got a lot of great press and commentary, and, you know, Peter and I and his wife and kids, we've remained friends now 20 years later.
Wow. You know, it's interesting when you talk about some of the motivation for these prosecutions. And quickly, even though I want to go back in time, it just harkens the case of Dinesh D'Souza.
Right.
And when you talk about politics playing a role, as you just talked about in Peter's case, how do you deal with that when you can see a bigger picture? Mr. D'Souza, of course, wrote the best-selling 2010 book, The Roots of Obama's Rage, and then is being prosecuted. Is it hard as a criminal defense attorney to see that perhaps prosecution is based on political motivation versus the evidence?
Well, the higher the profile of the client, the more likely it is that politics has some hand in the case. And, you know, Dinesh D'Souza, who's, you know, one of the most brilliant people I've ever represented, whether you agree or disagree with his politics. I mean, he was really like a rocket scientist. I mean, he hated President Obama and, you know, went out of his way to try and undermine his candidacy, his presidency. And, you know, payback's a bitch, as they say. When he did this, you know, you shoot the lion, you know, then you have a wounded lion. So, you know, I think Dinesh D'Souza made some, you know, mistakes in judgment in terms of campaign finance violations. But I don't remember ever seeing a prosecution of someone, a felony prosecution of someone for such a small amount of money. And most of those cases I handled administratively or civilly. And yet, you know, with D'Souza, not only did they try and prosecute him, they ended up trying very hard to send him to jail. And, you know, the win in that case was, you know, going up against a rabid prosecution and convincing Judge Berman in the Southern District not to send D'Souza to jail. I mean, I think it would have been a terrible miscarriage of justice. Dinesh accepted responsibility, pled guilty, paid back the $20,000, I think it was. And yet there was a full court press effort to put him in prison. And I was kind of taken aback and stunned by how hard they tried to put him in prison for what, in most other cases involving the same facts, would have been handled as a civil administrative matter.
You know, Ben, interestingly, and I don't want to get to the politics of the day because that's not what we're talking about today, but what you're talking about, it seems like it is just intensified over time, and the issues that we deal with now on an everyday basis seem to have this undercurrent of politics, which bleeds into the law. And one of the things that I've always admired that you talk about is the evidence, not getting swayed by the emotion, but dealing with the evidence. Melissa, you know Ben from working with him, and you've told me so many stories about his focus on the evidence and how he can take a jury or anyone listening to him and create a story as the consummate king storyteller.
He is that. I have never witnessed an attorney to this day, and I'm practicing nearly 13 years now, who has such a hold and mastery of a jury and who has such a mastery of the evidence that he puts his hands on. He turns that evidence into a story that we can eat, sleep, hear, all of it, breathe. We're watching it. We're involved. We're in the throes of it. We're in the thick of it. And, you know, he paints that picture such that the jury has no choice but to see it his way.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, and it's very nice of you to say that. I think every time I've talked about trial practice, the one thing I've tried to stress is you need to know the facts better than anyone else in that room, and you need to be able to live the facts. And one of the nicest things that I think have been said, as have ever been said about me in a profile where people, adversaries were being quoted, you know, one of the people who was formerly chief of the criminal division in the U.S. Attorney's Office said that, you know, my strength as a trial lawyer was being able to wrap my client in some of my own credibility, and that, you know, in a trial setting, in a courtroom, in a jury trial especially, you need to always maintain, A, your focus, and also your integrity, and make certain that no one ever, you know, looks at you in a way that, you know, undermines the integrity of the position that you're trying to advance. Because once you lose that respect, even for an hour, you almost never get it back. And in a criminal case, as a criminal defense lawyer, you know, you rarely have a constituency in the first instance. Most people think criminal defense lawyers are really not important, that they don't do important work until someone in their family is in the crosshairs, and
right,
suddenly, you know, I'm the most important person in the world. So when you come into a courtroom, you know, we talk about the presumption of innocence, but, you know, I think most jurors will candidly tell you that when they come into a criminal courthouse and they see some, you know, man or woman sitting there as the defendant, you know, there's really a presumption of guilt. They don't assume that you got picked out of the yellow pages for the privilege of being indicted. And it's a hard hill to climb. I know very good criminal defense lawyers who've practiced for 20 years without having a jury say, you know, not guilty. And yet, you know, they're good lawyers. So, you know,
they're
I'm
not like
the...
you, Ben.
No,
they can't. They can't make an entire jury laugh so hard that they almost cry.
Well, yeah. having the right personality is a plus, but. You know, it's 5% of the effort. The real effort is understanding the evidence, looking at the theory of the prosecution, and trying to, you know, understand what your defense is. And sometimes it's very, very hard, you know, to find the defense. And then what you need to do, and this is what I think I'm most proud of, you need to maintain a disciplined focus, because when you have the world out there, and the media in particular, writing terrible articles about your client and predicting that they're going to be convicted, and trying to overcome that extraordinary prejudice and not be intimidated by the process. I think there's something to be said for being tough and gentle, so that people don't look at you like you're just a mean, tough person. You know, you need to sometimes back off and be more personable than tough. So it's a mix.
Ben, we have to take a break, but it's funny because Melissa brings this up, and it makes me think about something I read about an opening statement that you gave that a bunch of attorneys were listening to. They walked outside the courtroom afterwards, and the attorneys looked at each other, and one said to the other, "How about that Brothman?" And the other attorney said, "Yeah, you should see him when he actually has something to say."
Yeah, I remember reading that.
That's funny. Anyway, we want to talk about character and credibility. The things that you mentioned are so important in presentation to a jury or to the public, and it comes from somewhere. So after the break, we're going to look at where this comes for, at least from Ben Braffman's perspective, the experiences and environment that created what he is today. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
That's on Lennox 7th Ave with News 1.
Coverage at Center Street got Braffman defending me, because New Yorker missed me if I'm locked in the penitentiary. The judge said, the Kit Kat Club.
That's Jay-Z. Got Braffman defending me because New York will miss me if I'm locked in a penitentiary. Come on, Ben. How do you get Jay-Z to write lyrics about you? We're talking to Ben Braffman.
That may be one of the coolest things that's ever happened in my career, but I will tell you, until someone told me about the song, I didn't even know he had done it. He did not ask me. He did not tell me until after it was already a track that was being, sold. And it's a collaboration, I think, with Cameron. And, I was in Jay-Z's life when Jay-Z was just starting to be really successful. And he was in a terrible fight in the Kit Kat Club, as I recall. And, there was a stabbing, and he was charged with very serious felonies. And I got him a misdemeanor plea and no jail. And I remember telling Jay at the time, you have the ability or the potential of becoming one of the most successful African-American performer entrepreneurs in the history of the world, and or you could end up in prison for the rest of your life. So grow up, clean up your act, and he did, and it's great to see his success. And every time I see him reaching another plateau, I think to myself, wow, I had at least a little bit to do with that. So it was kind of cool.
And you had a lot to do with Puff Daddy. Sticking with the music vein here, because, of course, you represented him as well, and you may not have celebrated him on the Shabbos when he, had his big party because you were at Shul, but it really meant a lot to you, didn't it, to be so successful with Puff Daddy?
Well, that was one of the most important trials in my career, and at the time, this was, 1999 or 2000, so it's almost 20 years. It was, the trial of the decade. We had 100 members of the media outside the courthouse every day. We had 30, 40 in the courtroom every day. It was an 8-week trial, and Puffy was facing 15 years in prison for accused of being involved in a shooting in the club and also bribing the limo driver. And he was found not guilty of all charges. And it was, I think, one of the sweetest verdicts I have ever heard announced in the well of a courtroom. And, you know, I take great pride in all that he has accomplished. And a lot of these young artists, they get in trouble when they're young, and they get in trouble sometimes for reasons having nothing to do with what they may have actually done. It's just that they're vulnerable, they're a target. And, you know, he's in the club, things got out of hand. Only person who was recognizable was, you know, Puffy at the time, so he got charged with the crime that I don't think he had anything to do with. But, you know, he stood up, he went to trial, he actually testified in his own defense because he was innocent, did not have to lie, and he was found not guilty. And, you know, the trial was prosecuted in Manhattan by one of the most talented career prosecutors I've ever come up against. And in fact, he and I have since then become friends with, you know, grudging degree of respect for each other. But it was a great trial. It really was. That was a trial that could have been a movie without changing any of the script.
Oh, for sure. He owes you a song, though, P. Diddy.
Well, you know? I'll pass on the song. I'm happy with the Jay-Z honorable mention. You know, but, you know, Puffy, in a sense, you know, no one who is among his fan base today was even alive or even remembers that case. So, you know, these guys go on to have great success, and they've, you know, become adults.
Thanks to you.
Middle-aged men, and they want to forget those dark days. So I don't blame them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so if you do a movie, you know, you've got to talk about all these cases, and you should. You know, there's so many of these interesting things that have gone on. You've been a model for Paul Stewart in an ad, so you could actually play yourself in the movie.
Well, they're doing a movie about the Peter Gation trial, and Nick Pileggi wrote the script, and Peter's daughter, Jennifer Gation, is producing it. And, you know, I met with the director, and I said, I want to play myself in the movie. And, you know, they said, well, you know, we'd like a bigger box office draw. And I said, look, no one is going to be able to play Ben Brathman better than Ben Brathman playing Ben Brathman.
So true.
So he promised me a screen test. He didn't promise me a part, but he promised me a screen test.
Well, that's not a no, Ben, you know.
No, I know.
That's not a no.
So, Melissa's voting for you here. So Nick Pileggi's here now. He's done, hasn't he been involved with some of the gang-related writing?
Yeah, he wrote the script for Casino.
Yeah.
He's the real deal. So him doing a script, Amazon bought the movie. So this is going to happen. It's only a question of when it gets filmed. And I think they're going to cast as many, you know, high-profile, well-known Hollywood leads as they can. There are only three big parts in the movie, and I'm one of them because a lot of the movie centers around the club world. They did a documentary of Clubland, and it's called Limelight, and that was a documentary, and I play a big part in that because I tell the story. And, you know, Peter Gation's trial and the story of why he got prosecuted, how he got prosecuted, that's really, you know, one of the most fascinating undertakings I've ever been involved in. And it's good that it worked out because had it not worked out, I think your guest, Judge Block, if Peter had been convicted under the sentencing guidelines, would have imposed a very serious sentence, and Peter might, you know, today be getting out of jail. And just so as an aside, he didn't flee to Canada. He ended up getting deported. Peter never became a citizen. And after the trial, I mean, you know, it's hard to beat the government. You know, they don't let you win. They actually deported Peter.
So. Yeah, I actually had to marry my wife to stay here because I think I was going to be on the same trail as Peter. So I was maybe he was already married at the time, but that would be my recommendation.
But we got him back. You know, he came back to the United States a couple of times because we found out that Peter has, believe it or not, a fair degree of Native American blood. And as a result, he was able to get a passport as a Native American and able to travel with it. So he's been back to the United States on several occasions, and can come back and forth whenever he wants to now.
And he can be a consultant for the movie. I can imagine the music, the soundtrack would be amazing in that film.
Well, you know, the club world, what Peter gave birth to some of the major stars today got their start. Jay-Z, Puffy, 50 Cent, you know, most of those guys had no following until Peter gave him a shot. And, you know, at the end of the day, when Peter was closed down and even after he was acquitted, the mayor took the clubs away under the nuisance law. And there are no real clubs left in New York. You have bottle clubs now where yeah. celebrities and models go to be seen. But, you know, in Peter's clubs on a Friday, Saturday night, you could have 3,000 people in the limelight.
You know, Ben...
10 different bands performing. That's
when you gone. When you talk about that, it's interesting you talk about the changes in the New York nightlife. The New Yorker wrote an article about you, and they called it the last of the big-time defense attorneys.
Right.
So,
Jeffrey Toobin.
Yeah, Jeffrey Toobin. What does that mean, last of the big-time defense attorneys? Is that kind of analogous to what was going on in the nightlife in New York when you talk about you as a defense attorney?
Well, you know, my craft, as I call it, is hard. It's very difficult. You need to work very hard, long hours. You're under enormous pressure if you take it seriously. And the odds of being successful are not good. And, you know, when I was growing up in the business, there were some, you know, well-known household names who have since passed, Jimmy LaRosa and Gus Newman and Harold Faringer. Those were all great criminal defense lawyers. And I was, you know, the new kid on the block trying to break into that echelon of really first-rate criminal defense lawyers. And many of them who were there when I came onto the scene have either retired or died. And a lot of the people who are my contemporaries chose to be, you know, partners in the law firms and have, you know, some... involvement with the criminal justice system. But, you know, Jeff Toobin saw me as sort of one of the last remaining gunslingers.
So do I.
You know, the person who, you know, would be retained when someone really wanted their day in court. You know, most of the criminal cases got resolved by plea. Rarely do people go to trial. I have a friend who actually retired and lived out in L.A., Bob Katzberg, who's a great criminal lawyer and retired and has written a book which is going to be published soon. It's called The Vanishing Trial, and it's a statement about how few trials there are for a couple of reasons. People are afraid. They want to, you know, get the case over with as little damage as possible. More often than not, on a plea, you get less prison than if you're convicted after trial. Many people get indicted and they lose everything, and
right.
the government seizes all their money, so it's hard for them to afford to defend themselves. And, you know, Peter Gation is a terrific example. I mean, I carried Peter, because I really became his very close friend, and I was determined to save him, and became a matter of principle with me. But, you know, the government took away his clubs, and the clubs were the source from which he was able to, you know, pay his fees. And, you know, the last several weeks of the trial, I wasn't paid, and you know, till this day, there is a bill outstanding. So I hope the movie is very successful.
Hey, you better,
Peter
negotiate.
And I became very, very close, and you know, he and his wife and I and his daughter, you know, we're very close friends, and you know, you go through a period in a foxhole with which really blood combat, and when you survive, it's a bond and a friendship that hard to break.
You're a war hero, Ben.
A war hero.
I appreciate that. I don't know about that. My dad was a war hero, but I'm.
And I want to talk about, you know, your upbringing, your parents. Before I do, The Vanishing Trial sounds fascinating. We'll have to get him on the show to talk.
What?
to talk about it. You know, Esquire said about you, they say sometimes when the evidence is overwhelming, you have Brafman to cushion your fall. So I think when you talk about what you just said about trials and the old school and what you can expect from a defense attorney, you really need someone who puts all of their character into the defense of the case for whatever purpose. And when we talk about character, it's something that undoubtedly comes from your environment, your experiences. You grew up in Brooklyn, in Queens, and you had parents who are Holocaust survivors. They unfortunately lost their families. How did they play a role in who you are now and how you have been able to present yourself as an attorney?
Well, you know, I've often said that would like to be remembered as someone who is both tough and gentle and someone who is fundamentally kind, decent person. And when you are in the well of the courtroom with someone who is frightened to death, you know, what I do and the people I deal with, when they're in the trouble they're in, it's really worse than being told you have cancer. When you have a terminal illness or a serious health issues, everyone rallies around you, your friends, your family, your community, your colleagues, your employees, your the people you hang with. They all want to know what they can do to help you cope, and they love you, and they bring you food and comfort, and they hug you. When you're a defendant in a criminal case, you're a pariah. Nobody wants to know you, be with you, and especially if your case makes the press, and suddenly the humiliation factor is just outstandingly difficult to deal with.
And now, are you talking about defending Martin Shkreli, the most hated man in the world?
Well, Martin is probably also the most brilliant man I've ever represented. And I think if Martin could, you know, just be quiet for a little while and not make things worse by sort of, you know, saying whatever jumps into his brain, I think if he's left alone and he were in a lab, I think Martin is the kind of kid who could cure cancer. I mean, he really is a genius. And, you know, Martin came to me as the most hated man in America. And, you know, the amazing part is Martin was convicted, but that was probably one of the best trials and the best verdicts I've ever had. We had eight counts. Martin was found not guilty of the five most serious counts. And I think Martin was in the hunt for a very, very lenient sentence until, you know, he decided to essentially threaten or say something that allowed the judge to conclude that he threatened Hillary Clinton. And at the end of the day, you know, Martin took on the government and the judges and the prosecutors and ended up taking, you know, a very short sentence and turning it into a 7-year sentence. Martin would be out of jail already if he had just been quiet. But Martin is also, you know, I've always thought Martin is somewhere on the spectrum. I think Martin has, you know, issues. But, you know, pound for pound, you know, Martin's one of the smartest people I've ever dealt with, and he's very likable. I mean, you know, my trial team, we had 3 or 4 people in the case from my firm. We adopted Martin. We really liked Martin. We still like Martin. And you know, it's one of the great difficulties in my life that you do your best. You know, sort of like painting that initially angry with Martin, but I realize, you know, I really couldn't be angry with him.
I assume, Ben, that you don't have the same relationship with him now that you do with, for instance, Charlie Kushner or Peter Gation?
No, but Charlie, first of all, Charlie is one of my best friends, and Charlie is, you know, in my life. He's in my community. I know his family. He knows mine. You know, Peter is in Canada. He were very close, but you know, Charlie is you know, unusual in the sense that I knew him before, I knew him during, and in the last 15 years, we've become closer. I have enormous respect, you know, for Charlie, and I think he showed me a lot. He had a momentary lapse in judgment. He quickly accepted responsibility, took his medicine, and he's one of the most charitable, generous human beings that I think ever walked the face of the earth, and so he's unique on to himself in that regard.
Well,
but Martin is, you know, if Martin were not in prison and Martin were out, and Martin, you know, wanted to have dinner and called me up and said, you know, Ben, let's go out for dinner. I would go out in a heartbeat. I like Martin. We had some really fascinating discussions. He's an avid reader, as am I, and you know, we would talk books and politics, and, you know, Martin is an interesting guy.
You just wouldn't have the same Yiddishkeit with him that you do with someone like Charlie. You know, we have to take a break. I'd love to keep talking. We have one more segment. We got to pay for this somehow. We could sit here listening. I know Melissa's fascinated, but, Ben, stay with us for one more episode. We'll be back, and right after this, Gervie's Law. Melissa Lefkowitz, Alan Gervie, talking to Ben Raffman.
Need a new perspective on law and life? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Check it. Seems like yesterday we used to rock the show. I laced the track, you locked the flow. So far from hanging on the block of dough. Notorious, they got to know that.
Yeah, we're back. Not sure if Ben Raffman's name is in this song. Melissa. It should be.
It should be. It really should be. You know, his name was on the bar.
If I may go back to a subject you raised that I didn't really answer the question. You know, integrity and character. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Absolutely.
Okay. You can't do what I do well unless you really have, I think, a fair degree of integrity and also, you know, are of strong character. And that is because, you know, I believe in the fundamental fairness of the criminal justice system. I believe in the integrity of the system. And my job is to make sure that it gets administered fairly and honestly when I'm standing next to the person whose name is in the caption. And when you read an indictment and it says the United States of America against John Doe or the people of the state of New York against John Doe, I mean, that is a scary vision when you first look at that caption, because it means the entire world is on the other side. You know, I got
his life is in your hands. That's what it means.
I'm sorry?
It feels, or it means, that the weight is of his entire world is in your hands.
Right. And your adversary, this is not a business dispute where, you know, you have lawyers on both sides. I'm always against the government. And the government has enormous power. They have this tremendous advantage on standing up and saying, you know, I speak for the United States of America, and they have unlimited resources. And when they run out of resources, they get more.
David and Goliath.
Resources, they run out of resources.
Yeah.
So it's hard. And, you know, my parents, you know, came to this country with nothing. They saw, you know, the worst of mankind and lived through the darkest part of the history of the world. And yet they came here and they, you know, were working people, and they put, you know, four kids through school. I went to Brooklyn College at night. You know, I worked since I was 12 years old. So, you know, I worked really hard. Whenever I get honored by an organization or the Bar Association or pick up a plaque or something for doing something, you know, great, and I have to say a few words, I always say basically the same thing in part. I say, you know, there are people in this room who may be smarter than I am. There are people in this room who could very well have better academic and professional credentials. But I don't think there's anybody in this room who has worked harder than I have in the last 40 years as I have. And being on this treadmill and also running a practice, which is a profession, but it's, you know, business. I pay 15 people every Friday, and pretty much a lot of it, or if not all of it, is on my back. So it's not easy. What I do, and I'm proud of what I've accomplished.
You know, speaking of pride, when Alan Dershowitz, he's been on our show a couple times, I ask him, what is he most proud of? I think I know when I ask you, outside of all of the wonderful accomplishments in the courtroom, you have two kids, 14 grandchildren, been 16. Married 15 now?
16.
Wow. Right. They just, you've been married, what, 46 years?
More, almost 48.
How many grandchildren?
It's amazing.
Hey, leave me alone, Melissa.
You can remember it, but are they not, with everything you've accomplished, your pride and joy that you've been able to maintain such a wonderful family life, travel to Israel to see your son, being able to do the things that you can do, observe the Sabbath, and still have the balance in your life?
Right. It's you know, raising good kids and seeing them turn into good people and honest citizens and proud young men and women and marrying good people and raising, you know, great kids. Yeah, no, that's what's important. You know, the rest of the stuff is nice, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's not what really matters. But I think the two are very much intertwined, because I think what makes me, you know, good at my job is I take the work seriously, because I'm dealing with someone else's life, and I can't ever forget that. I've often said that I probably have talked more people out of committing suicide in my office than just about any psychiatrist.
That's true.
In the United States.
I mean, and that's true. And that's just your staff.
Because we're dealing with cases that have to do with liberty, with
right.
freedom. It's not
and
money,
and the
it's
fear. The
freedom.
Abject terror, you know, when the government
abject
comes
terror.
And takes you away in handcuffs, is nothing worse in terms of fear. You know, you get sick, you know, you can blame God, you can look to your family or a doctor. I don't have blood tests, I don't have MRIs or CAT scans or pills or serums or vaccinations. And I got what's in my head and in my heart, and you know, I'm dancing as fast as I can with the adversary, who is always 30 years old. You know, I get older, and every week there's a new assistant United yeah. States attorney who gets coming out of the printing press, who is 30 years old, boundless energy, with a, you know, great credentials, and all they want to do is
take you down,
do God's work. No, they think that a lot of them think they're doing God's work, and they're not. You know, people make mistakes, people screw up. There are a handful of people I've met in my life who are just bad. You know, they are wired wrong, and they, you know, probably were all better off if they are where they are, despite your best efforts. But most of the people I represent are good people who have just screwed up.
Absolutely,
they screwed up, and not everybody who screws up deserves the ultimate penalty of losing your life or your liberty. I mean, that's really scary business when someone
really
else
scary.
Can tell you you can't go home, you know?
And, you know, Melissa tells me that not only is your family at home important to you, but your family at the firm, Rothman and Associates. And it takes a village. I often hear from lawyers who are in the limelight, who have accomplished so much. And she said that your firm specifically are so dedicated and committed to exactly what you're talking about to their clients.
Yeah, but and they're very committed to me, too, and me to them. I got very good people who many of them have been with me for years and years. I'm loyal to them. I'm good to them. And, you know, it makes a difference. And, you know, they work incredibly hard. But, you know, I think when I hire someone, I think, you know, I'm obviously looking for someone who knows what they're doing. But very hard to work for me if you're just not, you know, a good person or a nice person. I think in 40 years I've jettisoned somebody, you know, once. I think one person in 40 years.
Really?
Primarily because I don't think he cared about the people he represented. And I think, you know, this isn't a good fit. So, you know, at the end of the day, I made some good hires over the years. And most of the people who Melissa knew when she was there are still there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Melissa, what was it like following Ben around? Because it must have been quite an experience.
Okay, so have you seen that movie with Matthew McConaughey? And
oh, yeah.
He has the driver, and he has the whole, and he's so charismatic.
Yeah.
So Ben puts Matthew McConaughey to shame. Okay. To shame. So I would follow him to court, and he would walk into this courtroom, and it's a still courtroom. You know, it's quiet. It's still. And he walks in, and he's got this vivacious charisma that's just oozing out of his skin. Like, he's just so incredible. And the jury is eating out of his hands. The court is eating out of his hands. Everybody in the audience wants to watch him. He's all that, plus a bag of chips.
I appreciate that, but I got to tell you, you know, I've often talked about trial practice, and I've said that, you know, yeah, personality and charisma and energy, that helps, but it's really like maybe 5%. You know, The rest is just hard work and study and knowledge and learning the facts. And when I do a cross-examination, it could be 20 minutes. It could have taken me a month to prepare those 20 minutes. And, you know, when I stand up, I have a notebook or notes as a security blanket, but I've just sort of memorized everything. And it doesn't come easily. It's, you know, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, I am a Sabbath observant. I think I've often said that if it wasn't for the fact that I don't work on the Sabbath, I think I'd be dead, because it's, you know, the pace is just so horrific for the rest of the week that you need to have a day where you can just stop.
And that you make sure that you lower your stress level, because we know how stressful it is being an attorney. And on Shabbat, you have a chance to reflect. You have a chance to think about what's important in your life. And you have a chance to get away from the outside world that can be really stressful. You know, we have really enjoyed having you. Wish we could have another hour with you, Ben Braffman. But we have come to the end of the show. Appreciate all the insights. So much important.
No, I appreciate it. Invite me back. We'll do another hour or something.
Yes,
That would be great, because there's so much to talk about. And, you know, we need to get you out here for the movie. I still believe, you know, you've got over 100 ties. You could be the man. I don't think anyone can play you.
He is the man. He needs to be in that movie.
All right. I'll take your votes and give them to the producer.
All right. Thanks.
And the director.
Thanks, Ben. And we want to wish you Shana Tova.
Thank you very much.
Happy and healthy new year.
Melissa, say hello at home, and good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Back at you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
And that's going to do it for this episode of Gervie's Law. Melissa Lefkowitz, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I love this show.
Well, I love having you.
And this chair.
This was a great, great chance to be with Ben Braffman.
It was amazing.
Melissa Lefkowitz.
It was amazing. He's so down to earth.
He is
so incredible. I mean, he's one of the last of them, the great ones.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.